Oi, we haven't finished with the wheelbarrow yet. To enter, find out more or donate to Comic Relief, go to bbc.co.uk/Red Nose Day. We'll find the terms and conditions and privacy notice. You must be 18 or over to enter. The giveaway closes at 11:59pm on Saturday, 18th of March, 2023. Good luck.
Time now is midday, so it's time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the dancer Wayne Sleep.
Wayne Sleep is one of our most celebrated dancers. He's danced more than 50 leading roles for the Royal Ballet and had roles created for him by choreographers including Frederick Ashton, Ninette de Valois and Rudolf Nureyev. Equally at home on the stage of the Royal Opera House, performing musical theatre in the West End, choreographing, directing or teaching, he's known for his versatility, flawless technique, dramatic flair and humour. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Without humour, I don't think I'd got through anything.
And he made headlines around the world in 1985 when he danced, to the total surprise of everyone there, with Diana, Princess of Wales, on the stage of the Royal Opera House. More recently, Wayne's become a star of reality television, appearing on shows including Celebrity Big Brother, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, and The Real Full Monty. I want to ask you about this extraordinary career, Wayne, and about the dance with Diana. But first, your versatility as a performer. You've worked in jazz, tap and contemporary dance. But I can't help wondering whether in your heart of hearts you'll not always be a ballet dancer.
Well, it wasn't my decision that. I wanted to be a song and dance man. And they put me to some dance lessons. And I'd seen Gene Kelly on the big screen. Because we didn't have a TV, we went to the cinema. And they put me in for a tournament when I was 8. And I sang 5'2", eyes are blue. Well, I'm only 5'2". That's true. How fortuitous. So they said at that audition, I won the cup for the under-12s. We didn't know what was happening. I don't have a theatrical mum or anything like that. And then the adjudicator said, where's this boy's mother? He must learn ballet. And she went, my son, ballet, never. And she ran out of the auditorium. And they put me to ballet. And that's when I started doing it. I'd never seen ballet before I won my scholarship. But in my heart of hearts, yes, it is my favourite of the disciplines of dance.
You've chosen music from throughout this career, from Mahler, Andrew Lloyd Webber, John Kander, but first Britten and his Midsummer Night's Dream. Yeah. And you've danced Puck in the opera and the ballet, and also acted the part in Shakespeare's play. So I doubt there's anyone else who's done all three. Yeah. And I wonder if you somehow identify with Puck, a little bit of yourself in him.
Oh, yes, definitely. Well, I was small enough to play Puck. It's the only dance that I really qualified to do.
This is a wonderful score, isn't it, by Britten? It has a kind of magical quality.
It's, you know, you never know where it's starting or ending. And I remember it was the first opera I'd ever done, and Puck speaks, he doesn't sing, in metered form. And when I first started, it was so confusing because I'm used to a waltz or a 4x4, you know, and it was completely different for me. But I had a wonderful cast. James Bowman was a countertenor. I was with Geraint Evans.
That was a wonderful cast. Thomas Allen, Jill Gomez, yes. Geraint Evans. You say. Let's hear the ending where you really are very pivotal.
Of night, past the grave so very wide, everyone has gone this night. I am sent with broom before to sweep the dust behind the door.
And Wayne Sleep was dancing the puck role that he remembers so well. The closing scene of Benjamin Britten's A Midsummer Night's Dream, Richard Hickok's conducting the City of London Sinfonia, and Trinity Boys Choir, with James Bowman and Lillian Watson as Oberon and Titania. And as Puck, not, I'm sorry, Wayne Sleep, my guest today, because he's not actually recorded that role, but it was the actor Dexter Fletcher. Wayne, you are mentioned as an inspiration in Billy Elliot.
Yes.
But yours isn't really a Billy Elliot story, because you had so much encouragement to be a dancer from your mother, didn't you, eventually?
Yes. Well, she didn't want me to be a dancer originally. She said she didn't like the look of it. But she didn't mind Fred Astaire or Gene Kelly. Mm. But when they said he must learn ballet, because I must have had a natural facility with turnout, you know, certain required things you need. Unfortunately, I didn't grow, but that came later. Mm. But at that time, I was the perfect example for a classical ballet dancer. And they put me to that and it became a science. But just the idea of wearing tights, the sort of thing Benny Hill did in a sort of, you know, cod bit of acting or just humour, and that's all we knew about it.
But your mum was herself a frustrated performer, really, wasn't she? A good singer.
Well, my mother was just a natural soprano. She didn't know what it was, but in the war, when she was a nurse, they used to do concerts and she used to sing for them, and she sang a lot for charity. And she was offered a contract with the BBC radio in 1950 or something. She even recorded a record for the Odeon Cinema, which they used to play in the intervals.
Well, she was a single parent from a working-class family in Plymouth, yes, and really devoted her life to you, didn't she? But it, yes, did mean that she couldn't pursue her career. However, you've brought along this very precious 78.
I have.
And I've got to say that it's your mother on the 78 singing Dancing in the Dark. When John Calver, our engineer, put it on the turntable, I thought, we're not going to be able to do this.
Exactly.
But he worked magic.
He's just worked magic.
Cleaned it up.
And I've never heard it before because we didn't have a record player, and that's how I ruined the record, by putting a needle to my ear, holding it, and then tried to turn it 78 times a minute to make it work.
Yeah.
And I'm amazed what he's come up with.
Well, he put it into the computer, cleaned up, yeah, all the noise,
yeah,
and this is the remarkable result.
It's the first time I've ever heard that. It brings tears to my eyes.
Must be very moving. Joan, mother of my guest today, Wayne Sleep, performing Dancing in the Dark by Arthur Schwartz.
And she always said to me that wasn't really her type of music. Mm. She could sing an octave above that even, you know, and it was so natural. But she was more musical theatre. But she never got to do it because she was ashamed of having me in the first place and was ridiculed by a lot of cousins and people like that. And she didn't want to be answering questions about why she had an illegitimate son. And she did it to protect me. I mean, none of the wedding photographs when she did get married, because she thought it was such a sin. And she never really got over it, which is such a shame. But I'm so pleased to say she's arrived at the BBC at last.
Yes, we pay tribute to her, and we'll make a copy for you to take home.
Oh, thank you so much.
How old were you when you did start dancing?
Well, I became a professional dancer when I was 18. Everything was going fine. I was almost coming first in all my classes, my retests. I could jump, I could spin very, very well. And I did that naturally. And, you know, everybody was patting me on the back, more or less, without saying anything. And then I did my graduation performance, which got raves and everything. And never before have we seen anything so technical. You know, I don't want to show off too much, but that gave me my place in the Royal Ballet, even though I was 5'2" and the required height's 5'7". But then I was limited to the roles I did. But then I had Kenneth Macmillan creating works for me as well. We were treated like royalty. We used to go to America, I mean, almost every other year for 3 months. We'd do 6 months at the Met, and then we'd go to the Hollywood Bowl. We did San Francisco Opera House, and we were diplomats for our country as well.
How did the boys' training at school differ from the girls, or did it?
Well, it didn't. It was very good before I arrived, but when I arrived, one of the great teachers had just died. Another one had gone back to Denmark. He taught from Copenhagen. He was a wonderful Bournonville teacher. And so we had people experimenting on us at the Royal Ballet School when I was 12 to 16. And so we learned by watching. And I'd never seen a ballet. And the first ballet I ever saw was a dress rehearsal because the school were invited to watch from the amphitheatre. And it was called Giselle. And it was with two people, and one of them was called Rudolf Nureyev, and the other one was called Margot Fonteyn. And that's the first rehearsal I ever saw where I got hooked. I still didn't think there was enough dancing for the men. And when I became with the company and Rudolf had defected, I toured with them, Rudolf and Margot, for over 10 years. And he put men on the map. So as I was going through that period, everything changed. Now, there was only five boys to 30 girls at the Royal Ballet School in each class. Now it's 50% boys and 50% girls. And I must say the level of the boys, I think, is now outstanding. So they've got the right teachers now and they've got the right format for boys.
You're involved with teaching and bringing people on. You're patron of the National Youth Ballet.
Yes.
Regularly work with young dancers aged 8 to 20. And this next piece, Joseph Horowitz's 1953 ballet, Alice in Wonderland, is, I think, something you've worked on with them?
Yes. That's one of the first things I was asked to do. They said, well, you've been a patron 10 years. It's about time you did something for us. So I felt a bit guilty, so I decided to do it. But, yes, and they're wonderful dancers. They come from all over Britain, and it's a very good cause. And Joseph Horowitz's score is just superb.
Thank you. Ron Goodwin Concert Orchestra and music from Alice in Wonderland, the 1953 ballet by composer Joseph Horowitz, who died just last year at the age of 95. Wayne Sleep, as a dancer, your body takes an incredible battering, doesn't it? How have you coped with injury during your career?
Oh, well, I've been injured so much. I've had 4 sprained ankles. I can name them all. It would take all night. I had to have a total hip replacement. Because I had no cartilage between the bones grinding on bone, and I'd had groin pain for 8 years and stuff like that. This is like when I was still at the height of my powers. I'd torn my needle ligament. I've had a rotator cuff repair from lifting a heavy girl. Well, I didn't break her neck anyway. I saved her, but ruined myself.
Do you do exercises quite routinely?
I like to stretch. I need to stretch. And funny enough, recently I was back in the theatre doing a tribute to Judy Garland. That's why I did it, because she was, I was so passionate about her. And I sang I Got Rhythm and then did a tap number to it. And I'm lucky to say, you know, I can still, well, the rust hasn't settled yet.
Do you think the West End is in some ways even more demanding on your body than ballet, because it's so relentless, 7 or more shows a week, 7, 8
shows a week. Well, that's what happened to me, because I was invited to do Cabaret the musical, and I suddenly realized I had to come out with the fireworks, not just once a week or alternating with the opera at Covent Garden. Yes, and I had to do 8 performances a week, so I had to come out with the pirouettes, the jumps, and that was a terrific pounding on my body. But of course, I realised that I had to get into class every morning and work out. And sometimes you would think, oh, I can't be bothered today, I'm too exhausted. But if you don't do it, that's when you get the injuries.
That's
so I was very disciplined. But, you know, it can wear off after a few years being in the West End and not going back to Covent Garden.
Which bit have you chosen from Cabaret? Oh,
well, Gillian Lynn directed at the Strand Theatre. We ran over a year there, and we did a tour as well, which was sold out. And it was a wonderful production. And I think everybody would like the Money Song.
Money makes the belt go around, the belt go around, the belt go around. Money makes the belt go around, it makes the belt go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, a buck or a pound, a buck or a pound is all that makes the belt go around, that clinking, clanking sound. It makes the belt go round. If you happen to be rich and to feel like a nice entertainment, you can pay for a gay escapade. If you happen to be rich all alone and you need a companion, you can ring for the maid. If you happen to be rich and you find you are left by your lover and you mourn and you groan by your love, you can take it on the chin for the cat and begin to recover your 14 carat yacht.
What money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around? Money makes the world go around.
Or that we both are sure. Cold in the stove and you freeze in the winter and you cuss to the wind at your feet. Then you haven't any shoes on your feet and your coat's in his paper and you look sunny down from the wind. When you go to get a bird of advice from a fat little party, you pretend you would love evermore. But when hunger comes around, tat 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 tat, as a vinacy, a love lies out the door. Money, 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 a mark, a yen, a buck, or pounds, that clinking, clanking, clanking sound. It's all that makes the world go round. It makes the world go
round. Money!
It makes the world go round, go round, go round.
So that was you, Wainsley, performing as the MC in Candor and Ebb's Cabaret, the 1986 London cast recording conducted by Gareth Valentine. And by the way, you can find details of all Wainsley's music on the Private Passions website. And if you visit BBC Sounds, you can find hundreds of previous editions, which you can download and enjoy at your leisure. We were talking about how your height might have stalled your career, Wayne, but in fact you turned it into an advantage, really.
Well, I'm not one to say, oh, I'll give in. I'm a fighter. I've always been a fighter. And I remember Margot Fonteyn near the end of her career. She was 41 when Nureyev defected and came to England. And Ninette Devawa, who created the Royal Ballet, asked him to partner her. And she was 41, he was 21. And you wouldn't have put those people together in casting. And she lasted another 20 years. And she said, Wayne, there was always somebody wanting me to stab me in the back for my roles. And I said, what do you put it down to, your career? Having a wonderful choreographer? And she said, no, Wayne. Tenacity, it's a word you must learn, my dear. And it means staying power.
Well, you had many roles there. I mean, the Nutcracker doll in Nureyev's 1968 production. What was he like to work with?
Well, he was just running hot and cold all the time. You just didn't know whether you were getting a nice Rudolph or a naughty Rudolph. And when I used to work with him on stage, he was over onto my puck. I remember before we go through our technical problems, or we're looking for holes in the stage if we're on tour because it had a floor cloth over it, so we have to do it. And he said, move out the way, I want to do menage. Now, you know, the proverbial swear words. And I said, Rudolph, why don't you learn polite language? You've been here long enough. He said, Wayne, I learn your polite please and thank you, and they don't move or do a thing. Then I learn these words and they move their ass. And that's how he was.
Was there a part of you that longed to step out as the great romantic hero?
Oh, yes. I could never be the prince. I was always the jester. I just felt, you know, I was there in the third act to bang a tambourine and wake them up, you know, sometimes. And, you know, and the worst part about that is I was given a solo in Enigma Variations by Frederick Ashton, and you're standing in the wings, you don't go on before, it's 20 minutes in, and suddenly it goes, and I go on, and after you come off, and you're in sort of shock from a minute and a half of bolting so fast, and you think, well, that's it, now I can go home. It was sort of rather thin, you know, I mean, you know, and there's the romantic prince on four acts and he does his big solo at the end and he brings down her. I had none of that. That's how it is.
But Wayne, early on in your career, John Neumeier of the Hamburg Ballet chose you to premiere a challenging new piece.
This is the first time I'd had a ballet created on me where I was the leading man in the whole ballet, and it was all about my character and I led from scene to scene. And it was a challenge. And he came all the way from Hamburg and out of the whole company chose me to be the lead. And it lasted four performances because he didn't have enough time. He only had 4 weeks to create a 50-minute piece, which is ludicrous.
Yeah. It was based on Mahler's Fourth Symphony.
Yes, that's right. And I'm with Lynn Seymour at the beginning.
Yeah.
And David
Dancing
Wall.
With her must have been wonderful, actually.
Well, she was an inspiration. She was electrifying because you never quite knew what was coming next because she was so in the character. It didn't matter what she said. You know,
so emotional, too.
Yes, emotional. Yes, she was our leading actress, definitely.
Let's hear some of the Mahler because you must have got to know it pretty well, even though you might have got to know it better, ideally.
Yes, exactly. It's still done in Hamburg, by the way. Mm. It's a big success over there because you had time to...
To do it properly.
Yes.
Well, this is the Fourth Symphony from the opening. Thank you.
I was only in my early 30s when I did the Mahler, but I remember it so significant for me because I had a friend who had a brain tumour and we didn't know if he was going to live. And he'd been with me at the Royal Ballet School since I was 12, and he was potentially a great dancer as well. We used to silently compete with each other, but we were best friends, and that's how it should be. And
this was who?
This was a boy called Graham Powell, who was in the Royal Ballet, and then he went to Australia to dance. He was never happy wherever he was, really. He was always demanding better roles. But he was my favourite person, and I lost my best friend that night because they didn't tell me before my opening performance at Covent Garden with the Mahler. And the phone rang in the prompt room by the side of the stage, and somebody said, "You've got to take this call," and Graham had just died. Mm.
Music from the first movement of Mahler's Symphony No. 4, with Mark Albrecht conducting the Netherlands Philharmonic Orchestra. Well, I wanted to ask you about more quiet, private thoughts.
Yes.
Because you are, as anybody listening to us will have gathered, a very effervescent person at the light of the room. But I wonder whether, having done reality shows, all of these other things, whether you sometimes want to be out of the public eye to live a quieter life.
Well, it's true. I mean, the reason I do all these things is so that, you know, when I first started to do the, you know, the Lena Zavaroni shows and everything, I'd go into ballet class the next morning after it being transmitted, and nobody would talk to me, really, you know, because they thought I'd gone commercial and gone below the depths of what it was about and only doing it to get fame. Well, they're right. I did it to get well known so that when I went out with my own group, at least people knew who I was.
If you're a dancer, does music always inevitably suggest movement? I mean, we know, for example, just foot tapping, obviously.
Yes.
But with you, that might be tap dancing or something else.
Well, earlier I was re-choreographing the ballet Alice in Wonderland when I just listened to it again. I thought, oh, I could have done that step there. And when you choreograph on yourself, it's very demanding because sometimes even on the first night, and I'd choreographed it on myself because I couldn't afford the choreographers, I'd be thinking, as I'm doing a step, I think, oh, I could have done another step here differently. So you have to actually seal it. And, you know, it's like Ethel Merman, the great musical theatre star of America. This guy said, I want to change a couple of things. She said, you can't, it's frozen. Meaning if he changed that, she might have to change another bit later. And she said, there's another thing. Don't fix what ain't broken. So I learned that very quickly.
Well, music, again, from actually a celebrated and successful musical of recent decades, for which you too are well known once again.
Yes.
It's Cats, which ran in London for 21 years. Yeah. And you were part of the original cast in 1981. Mm. Did you realise at the time that this was going to be a big hit?
No. The lyrics from T.S. Eliot poems were difficult to sing. I loved Andrew's music, of course, but I just didn't see it quite working. And we had loads of struggles in rehearsals. It wasn't an easy birth, as they say. Mm. And we were changing things right up to the dress rehearsals. And certain people weren't speaking to certain people by then. Somebody ran out. Other boys got their kneecaps twisted and were off to hospital. Judi Dench snapped her Achilles when I was rehearsing it with her because she was going to be Grisabella. Mm. There wasn't a moment when something tragic wasn't going on. Yeah, so I didn't invest because I thought it ran 6 months. It ran 28 years or something, rather. But funny how it came about, because Andrew Lloyd Webber asked me to go and see him because he was putting on a musical called Cats, and he wanted to discuss if I would, you know, maybe choreograph it, or did I know a lot of choreographers? And he's saying, who's this? And I said, well, what about Bob Fosse from America? And he said, no, it's got to be all English. I want a British musical that shows the Americans we can put on a dance musical, because we always used to wait for America. Not many people know that, but how wonderful of him. So I went round there, and then he said, let's get round the piano. Why don't you hum along to this music I've just written? And the penny dropped. It wasn't an interview about choreographers. It was his way of auditioning me. And his wife came in and screamed, I didn't know you could sing. I said, neither did I. And that's how I got the role.
Which role did you play?
Mr. Mistopheles.
Well, let's hear, I think it's Old Gumball Cat you'd like to hear. Because you're singing on this one, aren't you?
Yes, I sing a solo. I was meant to be partnering Judi Dench in it, but tragically she couldn't make it.
I have a Gumby cat in mind. Her name is Jenny Any Dots. Her coat is of the tabby kind, with tiger stripes and leopard spots. All day she sits upon the stair, or on the step, or on the mat. She sits and sits and sits and sits, and that's what makes a Gumby cat. That's what makes a Gumby cat.
But when the day's hustle and bustle is done, then the Gumby cat's work is but hardly begun. And when all the family's in bed and asleep, she tucks up her skirts to the basement to creep. She's deeply concerned with the ways of the mice.
Their behavior's not good and their manners not nice.
So when she has got them lined up on the matting, she teaches them
music, crocheting and chatting.
I have a Gumby cat in mind. Her name is Jenny Any Dots. Her equal would be hard to find. She likes the warm and sunny spots. All day she sits beside the hearth, or on the bed, or on my hat. She sits and sits and sits and sits, and that's what makes a Gumby cat. That's what makes a Gumby cat.
But when the day's hustle and bustle is done, then the Gumby cat's work but hardly begun. And she finds that the mice will not ever keep quiet. She's sure it is due to
irregular diet
and believing that
nothing is done without trying.
She sets right to work with the baking and frying. She makes them a mouse cake of bread and dried peas
and a beautiful fry of lean bacon and cheese.
The curtain cord she likes to wind and tie it into sailor knots. She sits upon the windowsill or anything that's smooth and flat. She sits and sits and sits and sits, and that's what makes a Gumby cat. That's what makes a Gumby cat.
But when the day's hustle and bustle is done, then the Gumby cat's work is but hardly begun. She thinks that the cockroaches
need employment
to prevent them from
idle and wanton destroyment.
So she's born from that lot of disorderly louts, a true form of discipline, helpful boy scouts.
Purpose in life and a good deed to do.
And she's even created a Venus tattoo.
The Old Gumby Cat from Cats by Andrew Lloyd Webber. My guest today, Wayne Sleep, was part of that original London cast recording from 1981, conducted by Harry Rabinowitz. Wayne, I have to ask you about that dance with Diana, which we mentioned right at the start, Princess of Wales.
Yes.
On the stage of the Royal Opera House in 1985 for the annual Christmas party of the Friends of Covent Garden. It was a complete surprise for everyone in the audience. So how did you keep it a secret?
I think Diana wanted to take up her dancing again because she'd been to the gym to keep fit, but she wanted dance lessons. And I could teach tap, jazz or ballet. And she said, come and see me in the studio when you're free tomorrow. So I went down to this little studio in Chiswick somewhere, hidden away in a little sort of alleyway somewhere, and she met me, and there's this tall goddess looking down at me, and she's in a headband, pink leotard, pink tights, white jazz shoes and warm-up socks, leg warmers, and she said to me, I want to dance with you at the Christmas party. Now, every year we did a Christmas party for the Friends of Covent Garden, who used to contribute all year to help us with money for the productions. And as a thank you, the opera would come on, maybe do a couple of straight numbers and the ballet. It was a 45-minute cabaret, and they'd all get sausages on sticks afterwards. And it was always attended by a royal. So that was a very nice thank you gift. So I looked at this tall person. I said, what's the music? She got the music, Billy Joel's Uptown Girl. She said, now, what are you going to wear? And I'm thinking, you're going too fast, lady. And I thought, I can't do this. You're far too tall. And I looked at it. I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll choreograph it. And I'll get a principal dancer from the Royal Ballet Department who's gorgeous and all that. Anyway, I said, do you mind if I sit down? I've had rather a late night. She said, you naughty boy. And we both laughed and giggled. And I realised then she had a wonderful sense of humour. And I thought, we could make this fun. You know, not funny, but we had a sort of one-upmanship. So when I did a pirouette, she'd push me down on a knee, kick over my head and walk away to say, how's that? And then I would do another step and she would have to top me, you know, and tongue-in-cheek. And it was very slender. It wasn't like jazzy, sort of strutty work. We did it very elegantly. And when we walked on, so we kept it a secret by going to different venues all the time. And a lot of it was done over the phone because I'd be away and she'd be away. I don't think Charles even knew about it. He was told that she was going to go on stage. So, but Anne Beckwith Smith, her assistant, aide in waiting, I think, wasn't even out in the studio either. Her detective was the only one who knew, Anne Beckwith Smith. Five of us, me, Diana and Alan, who was my coach. And those are the only people who ever saw the dance. They didn't know what was going to go on. They were all scared for their lives or their jobs, you know, because if we'd done a funny little routine that was naff. When she walked on, there was an intake of breath from 2,000 people. They were in shock. And then she walked on a bit more and suddenly the murmurs created from the audience and it whelmed and whelmed and whelmed and suddenly they were relaxing. Then it got to that pitch of excitement from the audience. It just built together with us.
You wouldn't have done this if you hadn't realised that she could move.
Oh, no, that's true. I mean, I wouldn't have let her make a fool of herself. What I realised afterwards, when she sent me a letter, that night she sent me a letter after we'd done it, and she said, now I understand the buzz you get from being in front of a live audience. And I went, ah, that was it. It wasn't necessary dancing with me. It was performing with me she wanted to do. She wanted to perform out front. And it was 2,000 people. And, of course, we got eight curtain calls. She got so excited. She said, let's do it again. I said, no, leave them wanting more.
You became good friends, didn't you?
Whenever we saw each other again, the shoes came off, you know, at my flat. She'd do the dishes and be fun and we'd giggle. But the sense of humour. And I think she didn't come to me so much for the serious part that was going on in her life at the time. And things were moving so fast there. I think she just came to me for a break. I have my memories of her and, you know, she used to sit in the wings and watch the performance and she was quite witty. You know, when I got to the eighth curtain call, I said, you have to bow before your husband. I said, we have to bow to the royal box. She said, well, I'm not bowing to him, he's my hubby. I said, yes, you are. And I pushed her down. And we ran off and she said, you won't get your OBE like that.
Let's hear again the song that you danced to that night at the Opera House. And given what you've just told us, I think we can actually imagine that dance as we listen to the music that Diana chose, which was Billy Joel's Uptown Girl.
She was my Uptown Girl.
Yeah.
Uptown Girl by Billy Joel from the 1983 album An Innocent Man. Wayne, you're 74 now. Do you ever entertain thoughts of retirement?
You know, as I said, I danced the first time this week and the rust hasn't settled and I just want to get up and dance again. I felt this warmth from the audience and I think I did a pretty good job anyway, but I was being very careful, especially as I had cracked a rib 4 weeks before.
Pretty good in your 70s to be doing this.
Yeah, I'm only 75 this year. No growing pains.
Tell me something. I have seen dancing to, well, almost to silence. I've seen it to a metronome. I've seen it to a solo cello.
Yes.
I don't suppose to somebody creative there's any music you can't really dance to, is there?
No, there isn't. No. Also, I listen to the music. A lot of dancers go by the phrasing and how many beats in the bar. We have musical dancers and unmusical dancers. And you can certainly say, and I think Margot Fonteyn was a great musical dancer.
Well, we're going to end with your show Song and Dance, which you created with Andrew Lloyd Webber in 1982, and which features music from Variations using a theme by Paganini.
He'd done it originally for his brother, Julian, on the cello, and it was a piece specially written. And I said, can I use it? He said, oh, just a minute. He said, I've just done an album called Tell Me on a Sunday for Marty Webb, a solo album, and he said, I can't find a second act for it because I wanted it to be a musical. He said, why don't I put that on as the first half? Then you can do the variations with your eight dancers and do all what you've just said. And we'll call it Song and Dance and we'll call it a concert for theatre and we'll just do it for 12 weeks. And he said, I've just bought this little theatre around the corner. Would you like it? And I said, which theatre is it? He went, the Palace. I said, would I like it? and that's how it came about. Mm. And it lasted 3 years.
Look, that's a lovely upbeat note on which to end. Well, it's all been pretty upbeat. So, Wayne Sleep, thank you very much.
Thank you for asking me.
Wayne Sleep, Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, performing in his 1982 musical Song and Dance to music by Andrew Lloyd Webber, his variations performed by his cellist brother Julian. The episode was produced by Jane Greenwood and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. And you can find details of all today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds, where you can also download hundreds of previous editions. Private Passions returns next Sunday at noon, when Michael's guest will be the late surgeon Dame Claire Marks. We're off to the Wigmore Hall for a Haydn piano concert shortly, so do stay with us for that. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds and on most smart speakers. Just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Emily Jeffrey. The Italian authorities say at least 43 people, including a baby, have died after a boat reportedly carrying around 150 migrants smashed into rocks off the country's southern coast. A search and rescue operation is underway on beaches and in the sea around Calabria. About 80 people made it to shore and survived. The government has hinted that politicians in Northern Ireland could be given new powers as part of a fresh deal on post-Brexit trading arrangements. The Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab said the UK was on the cusp of securing a new settlement with Brussels involving less onerous customs checks on goods travelling from the British mainland to Northern Ireland. The FDA union, which represents senior civil servants, is calling for the government's health and safety executive to investigate what it says are widespread reports of ministerial bullying at Westminster. The government says it does not tolerate such behaviour. Dominic Raab is under investigation for bullying, something he denies. He told the BBC he'll resign if the complaints are upheld. The Scottish National Party leadership candidate Humza Yousaf says it's frustrating that the race to become the next First Minister has been dominated by debates over gender recognition legislation. His rivals Kate Forbes and Ash Reagan said they'd drop planned reforms to make it easier to legally change sex. Mr. Yousaf said he'd take the UK government to court over its decision to block Holyrood's plans, but he said people wanted candidates to discuss the rising cost of living. Jordan is hosting a meeting between senior Israeli and Palestinian security officials to try to bring an end to a surge in deadly violence. It's the first such gathering in years. Israel's national security adviser and the head of Palestinian intelligence are taking part. 62 Palestinians and 9 Israelis have been killed in the fighting so far this year. The weather this afternoon. The south and northwest of the UK will be dry with sunny spells and some patchy cloud. Variable cloud elsewhere with the outside chance of a light shower drifting into northeast England. Highs of 7 Celsius in London, Cardiff and Edinburgh and 8 in Belfast. BBC News at 1:02.
I'm Kate Mollison, and in the run-up to International Women's Day, I'm presenting a special extended edition of Music Matters dedicated to inspirational women in music. Across the programme, we'll meet 10 women who are making extraordinary contributions to musical life, from a musician working in prisons to a composer who's deaf and a wheelchair user who uses technology to break down musical barriers. Plus, I'll be joined by the composer Anna Klein and the violinist Hilary Hahn for live music and discussion.